I just want to say a couple of things before I start the show. First, I'd like to thank David, my patron who upped his pledge and has now become a Thunderwalker. I really appreciate you, David. I'd also like to announce that for patrons who have access to my Random Thoughts minisodes, you will now get an accompanying minisode with each episode that is in some way related to that episode's subject or theme, and I will try to release it in tandem. Lastly, if you haven't checked out my YouTube channel, click the link in the show notes to see some videos that I've made about the Wheel of Time on Prime. I will be spending time over the next several months making content for YouTube for the show. I will put in my best effort to put out bi-weekly episodes for the podcast as well, but I'm super excited about the show and enjoy making content for it, so bear with me if it takes me a little bit longer between episodes, especially since I'm still new to video editing. And extra and especially lastly, it's good to be back, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Stone won't fall until the podcast of the dragon comes to your device. Hey everybody, my name is Morgan. You might have known me as the Grey Warder on Twitter and Discord. Welcome to the 27th episode of Podcast of the Dragon. Hello, my lovely people. It's so good to be talking to you again, and I am ready to get into the Shadow Rising. How does one start a podcastical literary analysis of this book that dares to be different, that thinks it's too good for a prologue, that is just going to get started with chapter one? By calling it on its bluff and examining the structure of the chapter and the subplots it sets up, and then picking door number one and getting our feet wet with an exploration of the character of Min. When it comes to favorite Wheel of Time books, it seems like The Shadow Rising secures the top spot for a significant number of fans. And I think there are good reasons for that. As a book, The Shadow Rising stands alone. It's the book that starts to deepen the series and make it feel like more than just an adventure story. To use a cooking metaphor that will probably fall apart under deep scrutiny, the first three books were like basic oil and meat and seasoning. The Shadow Rising dumps all the vegetables into the pan and completely changes the texture and color and complexity of the dish. I have deeply personal reasons for my sense of The Shadow Rising. It seems nearly universally remarked upon that the story grows and changes in Book 4, so my impression of the book's uniqueness can't be mine alone, but sometimes I wonder if my sense of its separateness is distorted a bit because of the way that I experienced The Wheel of Time. I started reading it in 1992. Not in the 1980s, like that one dude on Twitter a few weeks ago. I read the first three books, and then got to the end of it, like I said in the last episode, and felt puzzled by the lackluster last battle, and further puzzled by Moraine's insistence to our very confused heroes that actually it wasn't the last. Randon kills Satan, but only his nuttiest minion. I went to the library. My first three books were store-bought. This was the first time I typed Robert Jordan or The Wheel of Time into a computer, and found that there was one more book. And my town's branch of the county library, which was literally 500 feet from my house, had the book, so I didn't have to wait for it. The minute that I discovered there was another book, I basically got instant gratification. And I have sense memories of this paperback that was covered in weird library tape that I checked out several times before I could get my own, while I reread it in this tight cycle of these four books as I waited for The Fires of Heaven to come out, which I think by the time I came across The Shadow Rising, I probably only had to wait 8 or 9 months for it, maybe. But I read it over and over again, and it was just this I don't know, this special book. It stood alone. It was different from the others. It was different because I didn't know about it. So it was like this magical discovery of, oh, yes, there is one more piece to the story. I'm not left hanging at the end of The Dragon Reborn thinking, oh, please, this can't be the end. The Shadow of Rising also stands alone for what it does. It is an odd bridge between two sections of the tale. It's one that has massive story growth, massive world building, character growth, and it's all tidily presented in this narrative that's divided into quarters. It is a really different format. It's unique. It's much more expansive than books 1-3, but very simple compared to later books that have more characters and more plot lines and just a whole lot more going on. But moving into the middle of the series, as it kind of is, it's a total break from the formulaic adventure story format of books 1-3, which are all oriented around a chase of some kind, whether it's characters being chased, characters chasing enemies, or characters chasing after Rand, and the artifacts that are somehow central to the plot. Whether it's an artifact like the Eye of the World that they're being lured to, the artifacts like the Horn of Valir and the Dagger that they're chasing to get back, or the artifact of Kalidor that Rand must draw so that he can be declared the dragon. Now, along with being the literal dragon, having accepted everything, Rand has become the political dragon, which is central to the story of the Wheel of Time. It's no longer just a rogue Aes Sedai and his best friends and a ragtag group of Borderland soldiers acknowledging him as the dragon, and also a whole bunch of crazy dragonsworn who don't even know his name and who've only seen his face in a drawing. Now he is ruling a country that more or less has been waiting for him since the Breaking, and it's acknowledged as much, in the sense that the Terran High Lords are guarding Kalidor, you know, they're holding it for the dragon. And while the idea is that they're possibly guarding it against the dragon as well, it seems like the understanding is also that once the dragon comes for it, it's kind of like at that point, he's in charge. That seems like the inevitable subtext of the Terran High Lord's job, and their four times yearly ceremonial rite of guarding Kalidor while it floats in the heart of the stone. This is the first book where the plot is not entirely bent around Rand and his destiny, with the characters having little agency over where they go or what they do. And instead of a mission oriented around running or searching or seeking, the plots of The Shadow Rising seem driven by duty and choice. Outside of Roydian, after Rand and Matt and Avienda have gone down, Mulaine lets slip to Moraine that she must also go through the apprentice rings. And Amys says, "It is the mercy of the rings that the memories fade," Amys said. "A woman knows some things, a few, that will happen. Others she will not recognize until the decision is upon her, if then. Life is uncertainty and struggle, choice and change. One who knew how her life was woven into the pattern as well as she knew how a thread was laid into a carpet would have the life of an animal, if she did not go mad. Humankind is made for uncertainty, struggle, choice, and change." And that honestly seems to be the real main theme of The Wheel of Time. A main theme that RJ could not adequately explore in the first three books, because to have a satisfactorily wrapped up tale, he had to have tighter, more adventure-oriented stories. But when he got asked to describe the Wheel of Time in 6 words, he gave it to people in 5 and said, "Cultures clash, worlds change, cope." So, uncertainty, struggle, choice, and change. It feels like so much of what goes on in The Shadow Rising is about obligations and difficult decisions. Structurally, The Shadow Rising is unique to the Wheel of Time series because it has no prologue. I've listened to a number of first-time reader podcasts or even reread podcasts where when they get to The Shadow Rising, they're like, why? I either hear people saying that they prefer this format, the prologue-less format, or people say that Chapter 1 seems like it should have been a prologue. I also notice that people who seem to prefer the prologue-less format as they go further on into the series often complain about the prologues, being like, oh, they're so long, why wasn't that just Chapter 1? The later, multiple minor point of view prologues that RJ does, which technically start in the Fires of Heaven, but as far as their structural intent, more truthfully begin in Lord of Chaos. These prologues are brilliant. I love them because he has so many minor subplots going on that would bog down the narrative if he was trying to tell them to you throughout the course of each book, so laying them out at the beginning in a prologue, kind of like laying out his chess pieces, and then as he unfolds the tale, giving you chapter 1 through chapter whatever, he could move those pieces into place where they fit into the story, and you recognize them because you saw them at the beginning, which is a very effective way to tell a complicated story. And because he does point of view so well, I find the long prologues to be very engrossing, particularly going back and rereading so many times. Structurally, Chapter 1 has the makeup of these later prologues, just a little bit simplified because it only has three POV switches. And if you look at RJ's habit in later books of using the prologue to lay out all of his pieces, Chapter 1 of The Shadow Rising is setting the foundation for what I would put in quotes as the three subplots of the book. The narrative of The Shadow Rising is divided into unequal quarters, and Rand's story is the largest one, partly because you can include with Rand what happens with Egwene and Matt, since they go with him into the Waste. Because of that, the largest percentage of word count takes place with Rand or in the Aiel Waste following the storyline with Rand. And while things happen with both Matt and Egwene that are significant to their personal characters, they are also used to make commentary on what's happening around Rand, and we learn a great deal about the Aiel through their observations. In terms of word count, we don't get a ton from Matt or Egwene in The Shadow Rising. We get about 9.25% from Egwene and about 7.34% from Matt, and it's all spent in Rand's AoE. RJ does spend time developing their characters and abilities, but I feel like both of them get developed more in the next book. Really, he makes the most use of their POVs to help develop our understanding of Aiel culture, and I think that is so smart. That is such a good use of point of view to couple it with world building. What great, concise writing. Perrin, who honestly has the least consequential subplot in the story, it has impact on him personally and on the people of the Two Rivers, but there are no far-reaching, world-changing consequences. Not that I could come up with, anyway. Perrin actually has the dominant point of view percentage in this book. He has roughly 29% of the word count, which quite outpaces Rand's 21.6%. And I suppose that with Perrin being the dominant point of view, he could arguably be said to be the focal point of Book 4. But there's not a very convincing argument for it. Too many other characters are giving us too much information about the narrative around Rand for Perrin to be the focus of this book, no matter how much of the word count he commands. RJ does do massive character development for him in this book. In fact, he spotlights him in such a way that he's able to just leave him out of the next book. He gives him a honeymoon and is just like, you know, go chill, Perrin. Chill for a little bit. Anyway, Chapter 1 starts out from the point of view of Min entering into Tar Valon. And I'm pretty sure the stone has not yet fallen. I believe that the end of The Dragon Reborn, Where the Stone Falls, kind of leads into Chapter 2, where Perrin has a 2-week growth of beard, which is 2 Randland weeks, so 20 days, presumably since the fall of the stone, because I'm guessing that he never shaved again after rescuing Fa'il. I swear I will never call you anything but Fa'il again, and I will never shave my beard, and I will do everything I can to be pleasing to you, except scream at you. Anyway, Min could be entering Tar Valon any old time after the girls have left to go to Tyr to hunt the Black Aja. But if we assume that the point of views in Chapter 1 are occurring linearly, or at least at the same time, which of course they are, there is literally no reason RJ could have for them not to be happening simultaneously or sequentially. The second point of view is from Dane Bornhall, just as they are crossing the Taran into the Two Rivers, so as or after Min heads into Tar Valon, the White Cloaks are entering the Two Rivers. If 20 days have passed since the stone fell, and 3 to 4 more days pass, like in the early chapters of The Shadow Rising before the Taviren hear rumors in Taran taverns about White Cloaks, and RJ gives a strict accounting at the end of The Dragon Reborn, so we know that Rand, Matt, and the girls are in Tyr for 5 days before the stone falls. I'm not certain how long it takes to get from Tar Valon to Tyr by riverboat, but Matt and the girls leave at roughly the same time. He left in the middle of the night or very early morning, and they left earlier the previous day. The girls get caught up on a sunken boat and have a mishap in Kyrian, and the second boat that they catch in Jireen is the misnamed Darter that is described as wallowing, which is a beautiful instance of writing. RJ picks this great descriptor that really sticks in your head, and then when Matt and Tom arrive in Arengil and disembark, you get this amazing paragraph that is world-building and time-sync in one. It says, Matt turned and shaded his eyes to peer at the river they were leaving. The Arranin was busier here than he had seen it south of Tar Valon, with nearly a dozen vessels underway in sight, ranging from a long, sharp, proud splinter darting upriver against the current, pushed by two triangular sails, to a wide, bluff-bowed ship with square sails still wallowing along well to the north. So, that's great. Matt and Tom have to ride from Arengil to Camelin and back, and the second boat that they catch, which is called the Swift, Matt pays the captain a fuck ton of money and forces him to sail day and night, so his fast ship catches up with the wallowing one, despite the fact that it probably took 2 days to ride from Arengil to Camelin and 2 days to ride back, and I am being generous. Looking at the map, it seems like it should take a lot longer. But Matt arrives in Tyr just a few hours after the girls, and I can't tell how long the trip from Tar Valon to Tyr takes in total, but at the very least, 10 days, I figure. And the point of this very complicated story problem, coming up with a number that is adding up to almost 40 days, 20 for the 2 weeks of Perrin's beard growth at the beginning of the Shadow Rising, 3 to 4 for the days in the stone that we spend before the Tavirin find out about the White Cloaks and the Two Rivers, 5 days before the stone fell where everybody was chilling in Tyr, and 10 days at the minimum from Tar Valon to Tyr, and probably more, I did all of that to try and guess when Min arrived in the tower. I think it was almost immediately after the girls left, while they're still on the river before they hit the sunken boat, before they are on the misnamed Darter. I am guessing that they hit the sunken boat at day 4, or possibly day 5, on the river, because shortly before they hit it, Egwene is ruminating about using the dream Tirangriel. She thinks that she has used it every night but 2 since they left. So at the least they have to have spent 4 nights for that sentence to make sense, and 5 nights would make it even more sensical. So if the girls are 5 days into their trip, assuming it only takes 10 to 12 days to get down the Arranin, you're looking at roughly 35 days, which seems like an awfully tight timeline for the news of the White Cloaks being in the Two Rivers to reach Tyr. But RJ works with it. At the time that Dane Bornhold is getting ready to cross the bank of the Terran, he's approached by one of his men. Dane, who might be a tragic figure if he weren't such an asshole, saddled with Padden Fain, aka Ordeeth as he is, head filled with misinformation. He'd probably listen to Jarrett fucking Byer if he told him the vaccine will put a microchip in him. Anyway, Dane took command of the campaign in the Two Rivers for personal reasons, having no idea how much fuckery he was in for, and with way too many soldiers on Andoran soil, the last thing he wants is for the Queen to find out about him. But lo and behold, one of the first things he is confronted with along the bank of the Terran is a clutch of tinkers. And because, to quote one of my favorite true crime podcasts, Dane is an asshole but not a scumbag, he chooses to contain the Tuathon rather than murder them, which is the suggestion of the artist formerly known as Padden Fain. It says, Lord Bornhold. Bornhold lowered the looking glass and turned his head. The hard-faced man who had appeared at his shoulder stood rigid, staring straight ahead from under a conical helmet. Even after the hard journey from Tar Valon, and Bornhold had pressed every mile, his armor shone as brightly as his snowy cloak with its golden sunburst. Yes, child Ivan. 100 men Farron sent me, my lord. It's the Tinkers. Ordeeth was talking to 3 of them, my lord, and now none of the 3 can be found. And, naturally, Dane is unhappy, and he goes over to Fain. It says, 3 of the Tinkers cannot be found, Master Ordeeth. Did you perhaps put your own suggestion into practice? The first words out of Ordeeth's mouth when he saw the Tinkers had been, Kill them. They're of no use. Bornhold had killed his share of men, but he had never matched the casualness with which the little man had spoken. Ordeeth rubbed a finger along the side of his large nose. Now why would I be killing them? And after you ripped me so for just suggesting it— His Lurgerer accent was heavy today. It came and went without him seeming to notice another thing about the man that disturbed Bornhold. Then you allowed them to escape, yes? Well, as to that, I did take a few of them off where I could see what they knew. Undisturbed, you see. What they knew. What under the light could Tinkers know of use to us? There's no way of telling until you ask now, is there? Ordeath said. I didn't hurt any of them much, and I told them to get themselves back to the wagons. Who would be thinking they'd have the nerve to run away with so many of your men about? So, from the beginning, Padden Fain is working to get the news of the White Cloaks out into the world. Later on, after Perrin comes to the Two Rivers, and you get into Padden Fain's head, you hear that he's annoyed that Rand hasn't come yet. He can sense that one of the Taviren is to the south, but he knows that it's not Rand, and so he's thinking about getting more people across the Taren and spreading more rumors so that Rand will come to the Two Rivers. That's the whole point of having the White Cloaks there in the first place. That's the whole point at the very beginning of the prologue of The Dragon Reborn, when he sees the drawing of Rand fighting Baalzamon in the sky at Falma in Patron Niall's audience chamber and gives Niall the names of all three Taviren. And then Niall says, perhaps I need to make plans for the Two Rivers once the snow clears. Padden Fain makes his way to the White Cloaks from Toman Head, talks his way to Pedron Niall, and manages to acquire a bunch of White Cloaks to get into the Two Rivers to start causing problems so that Rand will come to him. Presumably, the Tinkers Fain terrorized ran up to Barlon and passed on the news about the fucking White Cloaks in the Two Rivers, and then RJ's very fleshed-out world can take it from there. He has shown us how merchants are on top of keeping in contact with each other because knowing how trade is going, or what might be interrupting routes of trade or interfering with supply chains, whether war or natural disaster or some other fuckery, is very useful to being able to make smart choices as far as the types of trading that you do. And when Matt finds out about the White Cloaks in the Two Rivers, he learns about it because he overhears a merchant talking about Two Rivers tobacco. A fellow is saying that he wagers there'll be no tobacco out of the Two Rivers this year, and discussing what it'll do to prices, like I'll get a fuck ton of money for the Two Rivers tobacco that I have, because, yo, supply and demand. So, even though it's a very tight time frame for information about the White Cloaks to get from the Two Rivers, from what we know of Ranland pigeons, they could probably pass the information that Two Rivers tobacco is now an incredibly valuable commodity in that amount of time. I suspect it's already pretty expensive. I think Two Rivers tobacco is probably pretty expensive, especially if it has to travel any distance. Because, like, the number of people in the amount of land that is devoted to growing tobacco in the Two Rivers is not nearly enough to supply tobacco to all the dedicated smokers in Randland. I figure it's probably our equivalent of small-batch, high-quality liquor or something. So for traders, the news that it's about to get a lot more rare is significant. And I love that RJ has built a world where the fact that news of White Cloaks can travel from the Two Rivers to Tyr in 35 days is totally believable. What that would do to prices is big news, and it would spread quickly along lines of commerce, so that merchants and traders can adjust their prices accordingly and make strategic decisions. And I love that. That is such a rich, filled-out world, and it's beautiful. And then, the third point of view that we get in this not-a-prologue is from the High Lady Surith, which, you know, she sucks. But it's important to let us know that the Seanchan aren't gone. We haven't seen them for a book, but RJ is going to let you know, hey, yo, they're sitting in Cantoran Harbor, where it says, vessels of the Athan Mier, the sea folk, fill the inner harbor behind the sea wall, even the largest looking too narrow for their length. Cut rigging made their yards and booms slant at crazy angles. Their decks were empty, their crews ashore and under guard, as were any in these islands who had the skill to sail the open land. So it lets you know that they have a sea folk island. In fact, sounds like more than one. That's no bueno. And it also brings up the sea folk in Chapter 1, which is useful. You get a mental picture of their ships, which is great for when the raker that docks in Tyr is brought up a little bit later on, first by the young lordlings that Matt is playing cards with, and then eventually as potential passage for Nynaeve and Elaine to take to Tanchico. RJ's very good about casually inserting things in a very tangential conversation or descriptions, just not in your face at all, where they're brought to mind because actually someone was just talking about that in a completely unrelated way. He is wonderful at that. But we get this from Surith. She had worked something of a miracle in rallying most of the Seanchan forces after the debacle the High Lord Turek had led them to. All but a handful of the vessels that had escaped from Falma lay under her control, and no one questioned her right to command the Hylene, the Forerunners. If her miracle held, no one on the mainland suspected they were here, waiting to take back the lands the Empress had sent them to reclaim, waiting to achieve the Corrin, the Return. Her agents already scouted the way. So this third little bit of this three-part, not a prologue chapter lets us know if she's got agents. We soon learn these agents are in Tanchico, and we will meet them soon enough. We actually see Tanchico from Aegeonin's point of view before we see it from Elaine at Nynaeve's. And however much this chapter isn't a prologue, it's totally a prologue. It lays a foundation for subplots, because in the end, however much Perrin is the dominant POV, his story is secondary. This is the first book where Rand is the political dragon. It's the book where he is beginning to exert authority and secure power and make decisions as a ruler. It's the book where he learns the history of the Aiel people and begins to bring them to him. He begins to start to be the Kara Karn. This book is focused on Rand. You cannot go through the columns in Roydian and learn everything you do about the Aiel and not think this book is really about Rand and about Roydian and about everything that goes on in the Waste. This not a prologue gives us one of our first glimpses of Robert Jordan's talent at his long game. The Seanchan have sat out an entire book, and now he's bringing them back in and has them positioned to make a return, so we know that they're waiting. We know there are scouts in Tanchico, or that Cirrus people are scouting the way, and then later on we meet them in Tanchico. And even more, we get to see the event set up from the prologue of The Dragon Reborn. The White Cloaks are now in the Two Rivers, so he used a previous prologue to prepare events in the next book, you know. Last book, set up events in this book, and he does that again later. The best example I can think of is in the prologue of Book 10 of Crossroads of Trilight. It starts out from Rodolite Araldus' point of view, someone who we had heard of but never heard from. And we're in his head, seeing him plan with Dragonsworn to fuck with the Seanchan. And then we don't hear from him again until the prologue of Book 11, when we see him attacking an outpost. So I really love what RJ does with his prologues. I feel like he is very artful with them. I get, because the books are so complex, I really get first-time readers or people who are zoomed into the story and really reading it at a minute level and so aren't taking a step back to look at the whole thing and be like, what is the structure being laid out here? You know, what is the purpose here? Why is this being written this particular way? And asking that more meta question, I can see people getting frustrated with complicated prologues that are really long and populated with minor characters that they may not give a shit about. But I love his prologues. And yeah, I think that Chapter 1 should be a prologue. For one thing, the Fires of Heaven prologue is very, very similar. It, too, only covers three point of views. But they are less directly involved with the main plot, so maybe that's why it's a prologue and this one isn't, you know? This one is a much more straightforward setup. Or maybe it's that it's Min, and Min is too important to relegate to a mere prologue, because other future prologues begin with people like Elaida, Demandred, Queen Atheniella of Kandor, Rodolite Araldus, like I said, Galad. A couple begin from the point of view of randos we've never heard of before. The exception to my theory is Towers of Midnight, whose prologue starts from the point of view of Lon. He, like Min, can be considered a secondary main character. There are so many characters, I feel like there have to be more tiers than main, secondary, and tertiary. Like, Rand, Matt, Perrin, and Egwene are the main characters. Min and Lon, as well as, like, Elaine and Nynaeve Swan and some others are secondary main characters. And, like, Elaida, Morghese, Farron, Tom Marilyn, etc. are all what I would call elite secondary characters. And then people like Talanas, Andril, Bale Doman, etc. are secondary characters. And I feel like there must be high-level tertiary characters as well, because I don't think people like Teslin, Baradon, or Chell Vannin are important enough to be secondary characters, but they're not as insignificant as other Aes Sedai or Band of the Red Hand members that also have names and backgrounds and significant places in the story, but more truly count as tertiary characters. And the whole purpose of this tangent was to go astray from the question of if Min and Lon are equally important, why would she warrant a chapter one and he only a prologue? And the answer to that, I think, is that Brandon Sanderson wrote a book based upon RJ's tried and true method of writing Wheel of Time books. By the time Sanderson took over, RJ had written seven beautiful, intricate laying out of pieces to set a board for telling a story, prologues. So Sanderson just followed that format, which is honestly an excellent way to write this type of book, particularly because the story in Book 13 is far more complex than the story in Book 4. I think The Shadow Rising is different because RJ hadn't figured out how he wanted to write his looser, more intricate story yet, but I also think that it's perfectly acceptable for this to be the exception and for Min to warrant a Chapter 1. She is setting off the shortest, but also the most explosive and consequential plotline of the book. I don't know that Min was ever a favorite character of mine, but I do know that as a teenager, I really, really appreciated RJ having a female character that did not conform to gender norms and roles. That was so novel. In this particular type of book series, particularly in the 90s, so novel. And it meant something. That would have meant something to me. I really resented the whole boys' clothes and girls' clothes growing up. I really resented gender roles. And I was incredibly lucky that my mother never forced that kind of stuff on me. She let me dress how I wanted, basically. So I know that I would have very much appreciated the character of Min, especially at the beginning, just from the fact that RJ had this character that was just, you know, hey, this is a girl in pants. She wears what she wants. She wears what she wants and she doesn't give a shit, you know. She wears what she wants, she does what she wants. And it being okay, and him presenting it without judgment. Or, you know, she faces people who are sometimes judgy about it, but they're just shits and nobody cares what they think. So I know that I would have appreciated her just from that perspective. As we've grown to have greater understanding of misogynistic tropes in literature, it has become clearer and clearer that there is a deep misogyny inherent in the not like other girls trope, because it casts femininity as being less. And I never realized how negatively it impacted my view of femininity because I grew up smack dab in the middle of when the not like other girls tropes reigned supreme, and I ate that stuff up. It really appealed to me because I have always been not like other girls. And so the idea that a girl who was different would appeal to people, because society wants you to hold feminine things in contempt, but it also has contempt for women who aren't feminine. Min would have been someone when I was first reading The Wheel of Time through that I could have seen myself in, and it would have made me feel included to know that in Jordan's world, being a girl didn't mean I had to wear a dress. It didn't mean I had to be anything. But I don't think Min is really supposed to be the not like other girls trope, because she's just a woman who does what she wants, and the Wheel of Time is full of badass women, the majority of them in dresses, and, you know, there are a lot of badass women that wear coats and breeches in the Wheel of Time, but most of them, most of the ones flinging magic around, most of the ones kicking ass are wearing dresses, and there are ones in coats and breeches too, and a lot of them are stabbing with swords and spears because it isn't practical to try to chop somebody up in a dress. But I feel like if the point of portraying Min was to have a character that's not like other girls or not like the others, it was just simply to have a girl who was different, and there was no other commentary or judgment about it. She's not better than the others, she's not worse than the others, she's just different, and that's it. Except, I'm almost wondering, and this just occurred to me, and it may have been an utterly unconscious thing, because authors do things unconsciously, I'm wondering if RJ was subtly showing a difference early on between Rand and Gawain. In The Great Hunt, just before Leandrin lures the girls out of the tower, Elaine says, "Min, if you put on a dress, I'll wager Gawain would ask you to go walking with him. You know he's been looking at you, but I think the breeches in the man's coat put him off. I dress the way I like, and I won't change for a lord, even if he is your brother." Min spoke absently, still squinting at them and frowning. It was a conversation they had had before. So, I think that in this early part of The Great Hunt, because Egwene has come to Tar Valon, and immediately both Gawain and Galad have a thing for her, but Gawain would never presume to be interested in a woman that Galad was interested in, and so presumably Gawain's trying to look at someone else, and so he's eyeing Min. But no, apparently if she's not going to wear a dress, he just can't. He can't bear it, because he's kind of a douche. At the beginning of The Shadow Rising, when Min arrives in Tar Valon and she gets taken to the Ammerlin study, she runs into him outside where they have this conversation where he's like, "Do you know where my sister and Egwene are?" And she's like, "Wait, what the fuck? They didn't get here?" And he's like, "Yeah, they got here and then they left again and I don't know where they are." And so they have this whole conversation and as he prepares to go, it says, suddenly he appeared to really see her for the first time and his grin became genuine. "You ought to wear dresses more often. It's pretty on you." So, yeah, it's like you ought to be different because then you look nice. Yuck. In contrast, Rand likes Min as she is. He finds her relaxing, he just enjoys being around her, and in The Shadow Rising, when we're first in his head, he's having dirty dreams about her. He's having dirty swimming dreams long before she comes back into his life, wearing high-heeled boots and embroidered pastel pantsuits, makeup, and longer hair. And in his dirty dreams, she's super butch and in the plainest of clothes, you know, taking off her normal ordinary coat and breeches to get naked and jump in the water, because that's how he knows her, and he doesn't give a shit. He's not imagining her as any different. And, you know, I feel like RJ dropped the ball with Min, having her dress up in her prettier pantsuits with her makeup and her perfume, because in her narrative, she's doing it for Rand. And, you know, more and more what I hear from women who dress up and prettify themselves is that they do it for themselves. They don't do it for men. And it's one of the reasons why they get so frustrated and angry with men who are such creeps. You know, men are who are creeps and they get mad that women don't want their attention. It's like, we're not doing this for your attention, we're doing this for ourselves. We want to look pretty to ourselves. And if we look pretty to you, great, but you can keep that to yourself. If we have a kind of relationship where I would welcome hearing that from you, fine. But don't be a creep about it. Admire respectfully. I like Min, but I don't like her as much as I think that I should, and that is almost entirely Robert Jordan's fault. I feel like she's one of his most problematic female characters. She has an interesting arc through this book and into book 5 where she has agency, at least in the choices that she makes to help smuggle Swan and Lyanna out of the tower once they're stilled. But her character frustrates me because of how often she claims to have no control over her life, when she would have it if she just stood up for herself. I don't get so annoyed at her prettifying herself up to attract Rand, and I think that's partly because I don't come from the same place as so many women who get frustrated with men thinking that they're making themselves look nice to get male attention when they're really doing it for themselves, so I don't have that deep-seated frustration. And I feel like because when we get to book 6, she's choosing how she wants to dress and wear her hair. That is agency on her part. And acting like she's doing something wrong or less fits into that misogynistic overtone of the not like other girls trope. Min isn't less or lowering herself by wearing makeup. But the fact that her thought process, rather than being, damn, I am rocking that mascara, and also, how good does my hair look? Holy shit. Is, now he'll notice I'm a woman. That is problematic. That said, I also feel like, however annoying it is that she's making herself more feminine because she thinks that's what she needs to do in order to be attractive to Rand, it feels like she and Robert Jordan, empathizing and trying to figure out what she would be doing, came to it from a logical place. Because of her vision, she knows that she has to share Rand with 2 other women. She doesn't know who one of them is, but she does know who Elaine is. And she knows that Rand and Elaine were making out, and that they've got something established already, and that Elaine is a pretty, pretty princess. So she knows that Rand likes pretty, pretty princesses enough to at least want to make out with them a whole bunch, and she's not going to change herself into a pretty, pretty princess. But she determines, I am going to change enough to make myself as much like I think he likes as I can bear. And that's the unreliable narrator hard at work there, because Rand never thinks that he wants her to be anything else. If she came to him in her plain coat and breeches, he would be into her just the same. He doesn't need her to be dressed up and looking pretty. He already thinks she's hot as hell. He admires her when she goes out of her way to look extra pretty, but he likes her no matter what. And so I'm not as upset about that particular part of Min's character, where she changes herself to appeal to Rand. But I know that it probably has way more problematic things about it that I don't notice, because I just don't experience the world the way that a lot of women do. I do think that Robert Jordan did Min a disservice in a number of ways with her characterization, but I don't think that she falls into the category of a sexy lamp, as is sometimes debated. She could not have been replaced by a sexy lamp, partly because I don't think Rand would fuck any kind of lamp, no matter how sexy, but also because the sexy lamp could not read Herodfeld's books and figure out that the seals need to get broken. That is a massive brain power move, and her reasoning that information out cannot be displayed in a way that's interesting, particularly because the whole idea is that Min is smarter than all of the rest of us, than all of the rest of the characters, than the readers, than everybody. And so she is doing this work that nobody else can do, because it takes a special kind of brain. You need a mind capable of seeing the bigger picture, greater intelligence, and she's just got the head for it in a way that none of the other characters do. And you cannot interestingly write that. And so it's just there she is, in the corner, reading books. And I have to give her that due, because narratively there's no way to make that compelling. All you can do is just be like, oh, she figured it out. But RJ made certain that Min had a more significant purpose than just being Rand's arm candy and emotional support animal. And so I'm cool with that. Somebody has to be the exceptionally smart one. And honestly, the thing that I like least about Min is a character trait that is utterly believable and not at all a disservice to her as a woman, since I have seen it appear in both men and women, and honestly, I've seen it more often in men. My biggest problem with Min is that later on, once Rand is doing very, very poorly, post-cleansing the taint, and he starts to very pragmatically start talking about his own death, she refuses to listen to him when he wants to talk about it, which is an act of emotional abandonment, and makes her... It's not like she's a shitty partner overall, necessarily, but that is such a shitty thing to do to your partner. But it's also realistic, and all of the characters are flawed. They are flawed in all manner of ways, including all of them when it comes to romantic relationships. Fael is jealous, Rand coddles, Perrin is obsessive, Mad is a moral coward, at least when it comes to Tuan. Each of them has weaknesses with their partners that they combat with varying degrees of success. So I should not hold against her being unwilling to entertain the idea of his death. It seems a deceptively mild flaw compared to jealousy or moral cowardice, etc. But I think, maybe for me, one of the reasons that refusing to acknowledge and engage with the possibility of my death is one of the worst is because if my wife were that way, I don't think I could bear for it to be a deal breaker. Like, jealousy would be a deal breaker. Moral cowardice, well, anyone who is not unapologetically an asshole experiences moral cowardice at times, probably more often than they care to admit, but Matt is the sort of moral coward that can't say, you're a slaver and a piece of shit and have experienced basically zero character growth over the course of the time that I've known you, and I don't want to be married to you, so how about you fuck off? Anyway, so I probably could not bear to say that it's a deal breaker that you can't even talk to me about my death, but her unwillingness to live in reality would be an enormous downside to the relationship and would eat away at my happiness. I would be incredibly frustrated by it, and it wouldn't make her necessarily a bad partner, but it would be such a drawback that I would really struggle with it, particularly as I got older and, you know, possibly ill or dealt with anything where it's like, really? You know, the possibility is death is there, and maybe we should talk about it. And I would eventually come to resent my partner's unwillingness to even entertain it. And so I get angry with Min, because Rand needs someone to be there for him, and for all the fact that she's physically there, if you cannot talk to him about the fact that he's going to die, then you're not really there, no matter what else that you do for him. Because in the end, that is the loneliest a person can be. But that is all later. That is post getting back with Rand Min. Early Min, before she leaves Saladar with the embassy to facilitate the meeting between them and Rand, is what we're talking about now. And we meet Min shortly into Book 1, and it's just enough to be introduced to her and her talent, and then she comes right back in Book 2. And we get to see her, she's a fun friend, and she's kind of the odd one out in the sense that she doesn't really have any powers beyond this weird ability to see things, which doesn't seem to do her any good, it seems more heartbreak than not. And we learn that she is the loyal, ride-or-die friend. She's the friend that, even though she's pissed as hell at Moraine for telling her to come to Tar Valon and then not being there when she arrives, keeps her mouth shut, doesn't give any information to Elida. She's the one who could have left Egwene and walked out of Falma once she swore to obey, await, and serve, but would never fucking leave her, and spent her whole time there, divided between trying to keep up Egwene's morale and trying to find a way to get her out of there. She found Bael Doman and was working on talking him into leaving, just doing everything that she could to make sure she could get Egwene out. Would never ever have left her behind, so we know that she is good people. In The Great Hunt, when Egwene asks why Min is in Tar Valon, it says, I am here, Min said carefully, because I was sent for and I was given the choice between riding and coming tied in a sack. You always exaggerated, Elaine said. Shiriam Sedai saw the letter, and she says it was a request. Min sees things, Egwene. That's why she's here, so the Aes Sedai can study how she does it. It isn't the power. Request, Min snorted. When an Aes Sedai requests your presence, it's like a command from a queen with 100 soldiers to back it up. So either Shiriam is lying about the letter being worded as a request, or Min really feels so coerced by the general power and presence of an Aes Sedai that a letter delivered by courier, sent by pigeon, whatever. Since it came with money for Master Fitch to rebuild the Stag and Lion, I'm assuming it came at least partway by courier. Regardless, she's saying that a letter is enough to compel her to come to Tar Valon. Just a letter saying, we request your presence at the White Tower, which I can't fathom. If it's not accompanied with an Aes Sedai to be like, hey, you should come to Tar Valon. Should meaning will. If you can't get onto your horse, my warder would be more than happy to tie you in this sack. I just can't see. If she didn't want to go, going. She's just not a yes person, she's not a follower, and so I feel like she must have gone willingly enough because she's curious as fuck about Rand, and she's not going to learn any more about him staying in Barlon, and since she thought that Moraine would be in Tar Valon, a logical assumption considering that she sent for her, she figured, okay, maybe that's the best thing to do. If she wants to talk to me, let's go, I'll get some more information. Min is strangely obedient to the Aes Sedai, but I just don't think she would go if there weren't any around to insist, so I think she did want to see Moraine again. Min is dramatic when she complains about Aes Sedai ruling her life and never having any choices. She is almost as dramatic as Matt. But in The Dragon Reborn, after Rand's accident that he has with Saidine, Perrin says to her, Min, maybe you had better go. First thing in the morning, I have some silver I can let you have, and I'm sure Moraine would give you enough to take passage with a merchant's train out of Gildan. You could be back in Barlon before you know it. She looked at him until he began to wonder if he had said something wrong. Finally, she said, That is very sweet of you, Perrin, but no. I thought you wanted to go. You're always carrying on about having to stay here. And then she replies with the story of an Illyanir woman who was in an arranged marriage, and she spent the whole time in the arranged marriage being horrible to her husband, and I also hope she spent her whole childhood being horrible to her parents, because fuck arranged marriages. But she was shitty to her husband for 20 years, and when he died, she realized, oh, she actually loved him. And Min ends the story after parents like, I don't get it, what does that have to do with this, saying, Just because fate has chosen something for you, instead of you choosing it for yourself, doesn't mean it has to be bad, even if it's something you are sure you would never have chosen in 100 years. Better 10 days of love than years of regretting, she quoted. Which I really appreciate, because that is a positive attitude. And I complain that the Aes Sedai don't listen to Min and don't trust her own understanding of her ability. She tells them about her visions and that, hey, when I know something is going to happen, it will. I see this thing and it means this. And they ignore her insistence that she knows what things mean. So maybe my impatience with her lack of agency or her submissiveness to things is unfair, because that is a big complaint of mine with her. Maybe she just feels like there's no choice because she trusts her ability. I don't fucking know. Regardless, she's the one who has had to deal with her ability most of her life, and I feel like she's got a pretty positive attitude, particularly because learning that you're gonna fall in love with some guy that you just met, who in the ordinary course of things you would totally swipe left on, there is nothing about him that is like anything that she has ever really been interested in, but she rolls with the punches pretty well, and that makes Min pretty great. The Shadow Rising starts with Min's arrival in Tar Valon. Moraine sent her there after Rand runs away at the beginning of The Dragon Reborn. Moraine tells Uno that the Shinarans have to go to Johanna because most of them are wounded, and he's really the only one that's strong enough to ride, because he's like, we're gonna go with you after the Lord Dragon, and she's like, you're the only one who can sit on a horse, and I can't wait for you all to get better, so sucks to suck, you all run off to Johanna. And then, lo and behold, Massima starts talking to people, and the Prophet is born. That law of unintended consequences. Oops. But while they are still discussing who is going where, who is doing what, it says, Well, I'm going along whatever you say, Min put in firmly. You are going to Tar Valon, Moraine told her. I am no such thing. The Aes Sedai went on smoothly as if the other woman had not spoken. The Ammerlin seat must be told what has happened, and I cannot count on finding one I can trust who has messenger pigeons, or that the Ammerlin will see any message I send by pigeon. It is a long journey and hard. I would not send you alone if there were anyone to send with you, but I will see you have money and letters to those who might help you on your way. You must ride quickly, though. When your horse tires, buy another, or steal one if you must, but ride quickly. Let Uno take your message. He's fit. You said so. I am going after Rand. Uno has his duties, Min. And do you think a man could simply walk up to the gates of the White Tower and demand an audience with the Ammerlin's seat? Even a king would be made to wait days if he arrived unannounced, and I fear any of the Shinarans would be left kicking their heels for weeks, if not forever, not to mention that something so unusual would be known to everyone in Tar Valon before the first sunset. Few women seek audiences with the Ammerlin herself, but it does happen, and it should occasion no great comment. No one must learn even as much as that the Ammerlin seat has received a message from me. Her life and ours could depend on it. You are the one who must go. Min sat there opening and closing her mouth, obviously searching for another argument, but Moraine had already gone on. And then Moraine turns and basically asks Perrin and Loyal, "Hey, will you guys come with me? You know Min's not allowed to come, but will you guys come?" Which pisses Min off, and who can blame her? And as they leave the hut, it says, "How did you two become privileged?" Min demanded abruptly. "She asked you. She didn't do me the courtesy of asking." Loyal shook his head.
"I think she asked because she knew what we would answer, Min. Moraine seems able to read Perrin and me. She knows what we'll do, but you are a closed book to her."
Min appeared only a little mollified. She looked up at them, Perrin head and shoulders taller on one side, and Loyal towering even higher on the other. "Much good it does me. I'm still going where she wants as easily as you two little lambs. You were doing well for a while, Perrin, standing up to her like she'd sold you a coat and the seams were popping open." So first of all, I love that, because she is the one that points out to everyone, "Wow, you really stood up to her," which lets you know that Robert Jordan really wanted us to note that for Perrin's character in Book 3. And to continue with that point, I guess I should look at Perrin finally standing up to Moraine and how hard it was for him in that scene, even though he's a Ta'veren, before judging Min for doing what Moraine says. Because she doesn't want to do what Moraine says, but she does anyway. And we don't get enough internal narrative from Min to know how she feels about Moraine, compared to the way Perrin feels about Moraine, as far as friendly versus timid versus wary or whatever, hostile. I don't know that I would say Perrin feels hostile toward her exactly, but he's sure frustrated with her. But it almost feels like, in agreeing to go to Tar Valon, Min is taking one for the team. She didn't choose to go because she feels intimidated by Moraine. Yes, she is doing what Moraine says, Loyal's flattery aside, and while she feels steamrolled over, they're in it together, and she sees Moraine's logic, so I understand why she buckles to Moraine here. She sees that it makes sense. She gets that, yeah, okay, I guess I am the only one who can go. I am the only woman here besides Moraine, and so she gets it. She gets it. She knows that it's important. She hates it. And I don't think Loyal is wrong either that Moraine had to tell Min what to do because she couldn't risk asking. But I get why she buckles to Moraine. I don't get why she buckles to Swan. As we first get into Min's head at the beginning of The Shadow Rising, in the first not-a-prologue chapter, she is approaching the White Tower, she's on the island of Tar Valon, and she's concerned. She's really worried that she's not disguised well enough, and that people are going to know who she is, and she's incredibly anxious. She's had a rough journey. It's probably late spring at this point. The girls have left Tar Valon, and like I said before, I think they're still on the river ship heading down to Tyr, so the stone has not yet fallen. But it says here, she had certainly not come all this way to turn back now. The dress was a good disguise. Those who remembered her in the tower remembered a young woman with close-cropped hair, always in a boy's coat and breeches, never in a dress. It had to be a good disguise. She had no choice about what she was doing. Not really. Her stomach fluttered the closer she came to the tower, and she tightened her grip on the bundle clutched to her breast. Her usual clothes were in there and her good boots and all her possessions except the horse she had left at an inn not far from the square. With luck, she would be back on the gelding in a few hours, riding for the Austrain Bridge and the road south. She was not really looking forward to climbing onto a horse again so soon, not after weeks in the saddle with never a day's pause, but she longed to leave this place,
She had never seen the White Tower as hospitable, and right now it seemed nearly as awful as the Dark One's prison at Shale Ghoul. Shivering, she wished she had not thought of the Dark One. I wonder if Moraine thinks I came just because she asked me. The light helped me, acting like a fool girl, doing fool things because of a fool man. And here I get frustrated with Min for a couple of reasons. First of all, and this is not her fault, the whole doing fool things because of a fool man. She does a lot of that, you know. I do this because of a fool man, or a fool man tied my wits up. And I get that a lot of that is just Robert Jordan's gendered, men be like this, women be like that, you know. And that's just one of the things about these stories that didn't age very well. And while it is one of the main thematic elements, this imbalance with the gendered magic and the fact that men and women aren't working together, and there's truth to it in the real world, so many cultures, even cultures that consider themselves highly progressive, have very rigid gender roles and very rigid expectations, and that is only beginning to shift in some places. The shift in that narrative is very, very recent. But in listening to her, she does have a taste of that, not like other girls, superiority or misogyny, in the sense that you do get bits of inner narrative where she's like, I didn't think I would be like those girls who threw their hearts at a man's feet, you know, or toss their heads away or whatever and go chasing after a man. I didn't think I would be like those girls, where she has those thoughts of how she judged all of those girls, and now she's like them. And, I mean, I know what it's like to become something that you used to judge so horribly. I am quite a lot older than my wife, and I used to think a lot of negative thoughts about couples with large gaps in age, because even if the younger partner was obviously unexploited and a mature adult perfectly capable of making their own choices about who they wanted to be with, I would ask myself what is wrong or flawed or missing in the older person that they would need to be with someone so young. And so I gained a great deal of perspective when I fell in love with and became involved with my now wife. Being on the inside looking out, I realized what an arrogant and presumptuous jerk I was, and I feel really bad for all of the judgy thoughts that I had, because I was a serious asshole. Like, the things that I thought were so wrong compared to, like, what is actually the truth, so I know what that's like. But Min does not appear to be experiencing any personal growth of that nature. Instead, she continues to feel contempt that she's doing something because of a fool man. And I feel like Min is one of those characters where she's kind of similar to Matt in the sense that she tells herself that she's doing something, and that's not really why she's doing it. She does not have the lack of self-awareness that Matt has, but she has this inner narrative where she gives herself reasons that she's doing things, and they're not really the reasons. And then she has a lot of hyperbolic complaining. Not nearly as hyperbolic as Matt, but she does complain. Like, there's just a lot of saying she doesn't have agency. And with him, it's just kind of funny because it's melodramatic, but with her, it frustrates me. I don't care for the tone of it with her. But maybe I'm being unfair. You know, I wish she didn't act like, because of a fool man, she no longer has any control over her own life. She had a choice. She could have chosen not to do this. She could have left the Mountains of Mist, took Moraine's money, and fucking gone somewhere else. But she took a mission, because it was an important mission. It's almost like she has spent her whole life thinking that because her visions always come true, people's choices don't matter. And then when she has one about herself, she assumes that she has less power than she does. Which kind of sucks because she's already low on powers to begin with. And I almost wonder if because she lacks power in so many ways, she lacks the ability to channel, she's mediocre with her knives, you know, she manages to stab Semiraj in the shoulder, but for the most part, her only real weapon is her brain. So maybe RJ made her the not-like-other-girls girl, you know, where she's in coats and breeches because she spends so much time not having agency. So at least she's not also in a princess dress, which, that's not a terrible choice. At least it breaks a trope. Anyway, Min walks into the tower, and I have determined at about the same time Egwene is ruminating as they're on the riverboat heading down to Tyr before they hit the sunken boat. And Egwene is thinking about all of her different dreams, and it says, a dream of Min springing a steel trap, but somehow walking through it without so much as seeing it. So Egwene's dreams often tell of present or near future events, because at that moment, as she's giving a list of her dreams, she's also dreaming about white cloaks ravaging the two rivers, and Matt with a woman who seemed to be tossing fireworks around and riding desperately towards something unseen in the distance that he has to reach. So all of those things are kind of going on either right then or they will be going on in the immediate future. And it is said that Aes Sedai know very little about dreaming, and they know very little about foretelling. And so, yeah, some dreams predict further events in the future. You know, Egwene will have dreams fairly early on that presage Matt's use of artillery. And obviously, foretellings for the prophecies of the dragon are told 3,000 years beforehand. But a lot of foretellings and a lot of these dreams seem to be breaking news rather than future events. Like Gitara Moroso falling dead when the dragon is reborn, standing up and saying, "He's born again, I feel him," clunk, and falling over dead because it happened at that moment. Or, as Elida is spying on Min being led into the Ammerlin's chamber and not fooled at all by her dress, and she is just furiously brooding about a whole bunch of different stuff, which I will discuss in another episode. It says, "Apart from everything else, it infuriated her that she could not find Elaine. Elida had the foretelling sometimes, the ability to foresee future events. If it came seldom and faintly, that was still more than any Aes Sedai had had since Gitara Moroso, dead now 20 years. The very first thing Elida had ever foretold, while still unaccepted, and had known enough even then to keep to herself, was that the royal line of Andor would be the key to defeating the Dark One in the last battle. She had attached herself to Morghese as soon as it was clear Morghese would succeed to the throne, had built her influence year by patient year, and now all her efforts, all her sacrifice, she might have been Ammerlin herself had she not concentrated all her energies on Andor, might be for naught because Elaine had disappeared." So, when Elida has this foretelling, House Mantiar was still on the throne in Andor, and Tigraine Mantiar was still the daughter heir. And then she ends up, because Katara's like, "Everything's gonna be fucked if you don't go to the Waste and become a Maiden of the Spear and stay there until the Maidens come to Tar Valon." So she ends up leaving for the Waste. Luke goes to the Blight. Queen Mordrellan dies heartbroken, and then there's the War of Succession for 2 years. And in the meantime, Elida becomes Aes Sedai, and then Morghese takes the throne. So Elida attaches herself to Morghese because she assumes that foretelling means that there's a lot of forewarning. And that foolishness, that foolish assumption, House Trakand, however important, was not the key. Elida not smart. Elida need take lessons from Narg. Okay, so the reason that Elida sees Min and makes particular note of her is because Min runs into Gawain as Gawain walks out of Swan's study really fucking pissed because Swan will not give him any information about Elaine and Egwene. And Min gets this vision of Gawain with blood all over his face. She has been inundated with visions since she walked into the tower. She walks into the tower and she kicks off the trap that Egwene has her dream about. And all of a sudden she's seeing dead people everywhere, seeing everything that presages the coup and all of the aftermath. The dead servants, the dead sisters, the dead warders, the dead guardsmen. Bad shit's gonna happen. And then she sees the vision with Gawain. It says, "Min flinched. For a moment streaks of dried blood had made his face a grim mask. It was like a double hammer blow. Her friends were gone. It had eased her coming to the tower knowing they were here, and Gawain was going to be wounded on the day the Aes Sedai died. Despite all she had seen since entering the tower, despite her fear, none of it had really touched her personally until now. Disaster striking the tower would spread far from Tar Valon, yet she was not of the tower and never could be. But Gawain was someone she knew, someone she liked, and he was going to be hurt more than the blood told, hurt somehow deeper than wounds to his flesh. It hit her that if catastrophe seized the tower, not only distant Aes Sedai would be harmed, women she could never feel close to, but her friends as well. They were of the tower." So, she sees that, and then she gets brought into the antechamber where she gets a vision of Lyanna looking through her own screaming face, and finally she gets sent into Swan's office and curtsies to her and has a vision where she sees Swan naked. And it says, "Seeing things again, are you?" the Ammerlin said. "Well, I can certainly make use of that ability of yours. I could have used it all the months you were gone, but we'll not talk of that. What's done is done. The wheel weaves as the wheel wills." She smiled a tight smile. "But if you do it again, I'll have your hide for gloves. Stand up, girl. Lyanna forces enough ceremony on me in a month to last any sensible woman a year. I don't have time for it, not these days. Now, what did you just see?" So Min looks at Gowan and feels distressed because she's not of the tower, but her friends are, and so she's like, oh, this will affect people I care about. But she doesn't consider herself part of the tower. Swan thinks differently. She feels entitled to conscript Min to her cause with all Aes Sedai arrogance. As far as she is concerned, Min is most assuredly part of the tower. She has a power. It may not be the one power, but it is a power. For Aes Sedai, that's all they need. It's sort of like, it's a power. It's not understood. Whatever. It's ours. We own it. It's ours. It belongs to the tower. You belong to the tower. In much the same way with Aes Sedai entitlement, they feel that the Ta'veren belong to the tower. And it actually only just occurred to me in doing this episode that with Swan's tight smile on her face, Matt is just a few days gone from Tar Valon as well. If the girls are on the riverboat downriver, then he must be on Juan Malia's ship listening to him praise the High Lord Salmon. So Swan has lost her Ta'veren. And who knows, the sisters and the guards may still be searching the city, looking for Matt at the time that Min comes to the tower. I'm not certain how long they would search before they gave up and accepted that he was gone, but Swan felt entitled to keep Matt. Swan would have felt entitled to keep Perrin had Moraine gotten him to go onto a ship to Tar Valon. Once Fayul got caught in the hedgehog trap and Moraine was like, you need to get onto a boat to Tar Valon, Perrin's like, go fuck yourself, I'm staying here. If he had made it to Tar Valon and Swan got a hold of him, she would have felt entitled to keep him. She's just like, Ta'veren, there's powers with Ta'veren. We're Aes Sedai. We own powers. We own everything. And, you know, conscript him as well. Or try to. Perrin would have told her no. And honestly, that's a confrontation I desperately wish that Jordan had written. I love the idea of Swan as Amarlin realizing that not all of her power or will could make Perrin do what he doesn't feel like doing. God, I wish I could have seen that. He would have told her no. Anyway. But Min left the White Tower because she had the right to leave, and did her own thing because that's her right. She's not a sister, she's not a novice, she's not accepted. She's a freaking girl from the western part of Andor, does her own thing. She came to Tar Valon with a note, supposedly worded as a request, at least according to Shirium, which she felt was a demand, and I think she probably came because she wanted to know more about what was going on with Rand and wanted more information from Moraine, obviously desperately curious, but then she left again, and she did not want to come back because who wants to fall into this trap that is a place with incredibly powerful people who can hold you if they feel like it while mocking you by acting as if you have freedom. So Min delivers the news. Rand went to Tyr, and Swan's like, he fucking went to Tyr? I'm gonna fucking kill Moraine. And then Min's like, she didn't tell him to go, he ran away in the middle of the night. And she's like, that fucking asshole, he's gonna get himself killed. And then Min gets angry. She's like, oh, he said you were gonna try to control him. So they have this little bit of snotty back and forth, and Swan kind of weasels out that Min loves Rand, and Min blusters about it, but Swan's like, bullshit, I am onto you. So Min tells her about the vision of three women, and it says, nothing to say that he would love you in return. Nothing. He has never looked at me twice. I think he sees me as a sister. So don't think you can use me as a leech on him, because it will not work. Yet you do love him. I don't have any choice. Min tried to make her voice less sullen. I tried treating it as a joke, but I can't laugh anymore. You may not believe me, but when I know what it means, it happens. The Amarlin trapped a finger against her lips and looked at Min consideringly. That look worried Min. She had not meant to make such a show of herself, nor to tell as much as she had. She had not told everything, but she knew she should have learned by now not to give an Aes Sedai a lever, even if she did not see how it could be used. Aes Sedai were skilled at finding ways. Mother, I've delivered Moraine's message, and I've told everything I know of what my viewings meant. There's no reason now I can't put on my own clothes and go. Go where? Tyr. After talking with Gowan, trying to make sure he did not do something foolish, she wished she dared ask where Egwene and the other two were, but if the Amarlin would not tell Elaine's brother, there was small chance she would tell Min, and Swan Sanche still had that weighing look in her eyes. Or wherever Rand is. I may be a fool, but I'm not the first woman to be a fool over a man. The first to be a fool over the dragon reborn. It will be dangerous being close to Rand Althor once the world finds out who he is, what he is. And if he now wields Kalendor, the world will learn soon enough. Half will want to kill him anyway, as if by killing him they can stop the last battle, stop the Dark One from breaking free. A good many will die close to him. It might be better for you to stay here. The Amaranth sounded sympathetic, but Min did not believe it. She did not believe Swan Sanjay was capable of sympathy. I'll take the risk. Maybe I can help him with what I see. It isn't even as if the tower would be that much safer, not so long as there is one Red Sister here. They'll see a man who can channel and forget the last battle and the prophecies of the dragon. So will many others, Swan broke in. Old ways of thinking are hard to shed, for Aes Sedai as for anyone else. Min gave her a puzzled look. She seemed to be taking Min's side of the thing now. It is no secret I am friends with Egwene and Nynaeve, and no secret they're from the same village as Rand. For the Red Aja, that will be connection enough. When the tower finds out what he is, I would probably be arrested before the day is out. So will Egwene and Nynaeve if you don't have them hidden away somewhere. Then you mustn't be recognized. You catch no fish if they see the net. I suggest you forget your coat and breeches for a time. The Amaranth smiled like a cat smiling at a mouse. So, it's like Min gets conscripted to the worst service possible, and then she has to wear the most horrible uniform. And I know that it's Robert Jordan having Swan say that Min won't be recognized. Like, we'll put you in a really fancy dress, we'll curl your hair, we'll have Lyanna teach you how to put on makeup, and we'll give you this dumb reason, and you'll act like a simpering idiot, and nobody will recognize you. And, you know, that seems ridiculous. And we learn afterwards that it was totally stupid because everybody recognized her. But I feel like Swan's arrogant enough that it is absolutely plausible that she might really believe that nobody would see or nobody would know. It just seems so typical of Swan's bullying and bulldozering and arrogance. I've mentioned in another episode that I'm not the biggest fan of Swan. I love her character and I love her character arc, and starting in the next book, she is so compelling to read. She is not someone I could ever be friends with, and I don't like her particularly. She is intractable and a bully, and I don't like intractable bullies, and I don't understand why Min buckles to her. She conscripts Min to spy for her, just helps herself. It says, "If you're still thinking of Tyr, think again. Consider whether you can be of more help to Rand there or here. If the Black Aja brings the tower down, or worse, gains control, he loses even the little help I can give. So, are you a woman or a lovesick girl? Trapped." Min could see it as plainly as a shackle on her leg. "Do you always get your way with people, mother?" The Amaranth's smile was even colder this time. "Usually, child. Usually." So Swan's an extra and special asshole, because she weaponizes Min's feelings for Rand, and she continues to do it into the next book to get her to do what she wants. And yeah, RJ needs Min in the tower, because her arc doesn't work if she gets on her horse and goes to Tyr. I get that. And blackmail is probably the only thing that would force her to stay. So from a writing aspect for the plot, it works. But the emotional blackmail and bullying that is the relationship between Swan and Min is a heavy price as a law of unintended consequences when it comes to characterization. I have such a fundamental revulsion toward bullies that I have limited sympathy for the troubles that they reap, even when the bullies are technically good guys. And I have such a determination not to give bullies what they want that I lose respect for Min here. I have a hard time understanding her because I would not give Swan what she wanted, no matter what. Swan would have to torture me if I were in Min's shoes, and since I would be so determined to win and not give her what she wanted, I would force her to wring me out until I was useless. She would have to break me, and at that point, she couldn't get what she wanted. And maybe that would make me childish in the sense that, yeah, technically Min can do Rand good. And so maybe it is illogical and immature to be like, because you're bullying me, even though this is for the best, I'm not going to give you what you fucking want. But whenever I read this scene, I put myself in Min's shoes and the narrative in my head is always, "Oh, yeah, sure, Swan, whatever you want. I'll absolutely do what you say and not give her any problems about it whatsoever. And then the minute that her back was turned, I would have my bundle of stuff, my horse would still be waiting at that inn, and I would be on it and gone. I would be as gone as Matt Cawthon, and Swan could fuck herself because that's what she gets for being a bully. Because you don't weaponize people's feelings and fucking twist their arms like that and not expect to face consequences." But fortunately for Swan, she's dealing with Min, and not a stubborn, intractable motherfucker who gets off on not giving you what you want when you presume to try to bully them. One of the things that makes me so angry about Min's conscription is Swan, who is keeping her for the express purpose of making use of her ability
refuses to accept that Min understands her own power. She just ignores her understanding, like, oh, you couldn't possibly understand what your shit is, which is just so fucking dismissive and infantilizing and so shitty. It's so shitty. And after she sees the halo around Loghain in the chapter called Deceptions, and that is the day that Elaine and Nynaeve get on Wave Dancer and go to Tanchico, Perrin, Loial, Faile, Galbane, and Chia take the ways to go to the Two Rivers, and Rand puts Kalendor into the floor of the Stone of Tyr and takes everybody by portal stone to Roydian. So this Min POV is after Moraine manipulates Tom Marilyn into going with Elaine and Nynaeve by saying, I'll give you information about the Red Aja if you go with them and get away from Rand, and it's before everybody gathers in the Heart of the Stone to hear what Rand has to say, and before he drives Kalendor into the Heart. So I'm wondering if what causes the halo around Loghain is Rand making the final decision to go to Roydian, because it sets his path and it was the correct decision where he won't die. Because Amys, Melaine, Bear, and Sianna, the Dreamwalkers, tell Moraine, well, we knew that if Rand didn't come here, then he would die. And if you didn't come with him, then he would die. And if Lon didn't come with you, then you would die. You know, so dreamwalking isn't so straightforward. We see possibilities and different potentials, but it's rarely cut and dried. So I'm wondering if at the point that Rand decides to go to Roydian and has also made the decision that he's going to get himself a Forsaken teacher and therefore for sure survive learning to channel, that opens up the path to make the Black Tower. He's going to survive and go on to do these things that will at that point make it possible for Loghain to achieve glory. So maybe that's what caused the halo. But anyway, Min sees it and freaks out, and she bulls into Swan's office to tell her about it, and then immediately is thinking, as Swan and Leon are like, what the fuck are you doing here? That maybe it wasn't so important after all, and what was really important is that she wants to leave. It says, I've told you everything I know about whatever disaster you Aes Sedai are going to face, and the rest of it is just useless. She had to stop and swallow with that penetrating gaze on her. Mother, there is no reason I should not go. There's a reason I should. Perhaps Rand could make real use of what I can do, if he has taken the stone. Mother, he may need me. At the least, I need him. Burn me for a fool. The keeper shuddered openly at the mention of Rand's name. Swan, on the other hand, snorted loudly. Your viewings have been very useful. It's important to know about Loghain. You found the groom who was stealing before suspicion could land on anyone else, and that fire-haired novice who was going to get herself with child? Shiriam cut that short. The girl won't even think of men until she's finished her training. But we'd not have known until it was too late without you. No, you cannot go. Sooner or later your viewings will draw me a chart to the Black Aja, and until they do, they still more than pay their passage. Min sighed, and not only because the Ammerlin meant to hold on to her. The last time she had seen that red-headed novice, the girl had been sneaking off to a wooded part of the grounds with a muscular guard. They would be married, maybe before the end of summer. Min had known that as soon as she saw them together, though the tower never let a novice leave until the tower was ready, even one who could not go any further in her training. There was a farm in that pair's future and a swarm of children, but it was pointless to tell the Ammerlin that. So I wonder if when the coup happens, the guard comes and finds the novice and he's like, yo, we gotta get out of here, you know, shit's going down. And they go off and live happily ever after, which, good for them. But Swan doesn't listen and doesn't hear. Min's like, what good have I done really? Okay, I found somebody who was stealing, but that chick's gonna get pregnant no matter what you tried. You cannot stop a girl who is down to get down from getting down, no matter how much you try to beat the thirst out of her. And what good really is knowing about Loghain's halo? None of this is helpful. And Swan is just, once again, she's going to have her way because she is intractable and she's like, I am the Ammerlin and I'm going to have what I want because she's in charge. And she thinks she knows more than she does. And she thinks that she's right. And in Min's shoes, I would leave. But Min is not like that. She feels loyalty, even to Aes Sedai, who she wants to throttle. And she mostly feels loyalty to Rand, who she wants to help and support, and the maybes and the ifs that Swan feeds her, where she's like, you can probably help me. You could help me support Rand or help Rand. What you're doing is probably helpful, you know? Are you grown up enough to stay here and help? Her just that constant needling and weaponizing of Min's emotions, just enough to blackmail her emotionally, to keep her under control. But Min chooses not to leave.
And despite Swan's arrogance and entitlement, her intractability and her douchebaggery, when Min comes back from Joanne's with the fabric that Laris sends her for, and finds the deserted guard posts and smoke, and then Bloody Gowan comes along with all of his younglings and their swords and their spears, and he's like, "You need to get out of here. You need to get out of here now. It isn't safe. Go while you can." She doesn't take advantage of the excuse to leave. She has an actual chance, but doesn't grab the opportunity that she has been longing for, even though she's terrified as well as frustrated. When she finds out that Swan has been deposed, she drops her fabric from Joanne's onto the fucking grounds and is like, "What?" And he runs off, and she's like, "You didn't say what side you were on." It says, "The sounds of fighting were louder, clearer now that she was paying attention, and the shouts and yells, the clash of steel on steel, seemed to come from every direction. The clamor made her skin crawl and her knees shake. This could not be happening. Not here. Gowan was right. It would be much the safer thing, much the smarter, to leave the tower grounds immediately. Only there was no telling when or if she would be allowed back, and she could not think of much good she could do outside. What good can I do inside?" she asked herself fiercely. But she did not turn back toward the gate. Leaving the silk where it lay, she hurried into the trees, looking for a place to hide. She did not think anyone would spit Elmandretta like a goose. Shivering, she wished she had not thought of it that way. But there was no use in taking foolish chances. Sooner or later, the fighting had to die down, and by that time, she needed to decide what to do next. And I appreciate how subtly he highlights her PTSD, or her trauma here, since she was at Falma and knows the sound of war, and has actually been in on-the-ground combat, like ducking fireballs. You know, this is not new to her. And so having her just like that instant skin-crawling, trembling reaction, like she is hardwired to have a reaction to these sounds. And I like that he does a nod to that. And for the narrative to continue, and for one of the most significant and important arcs and sections of the story connecting to Saladar being able to go on and succeed, Egwene being able to become Amyrlin, the Bull of the Winds to be found, all of those things, Min must free Swan. Even though her bullying means that she doesn't really deserve it, at least she doesn't deserve to be rescued by Min, but Lyanna deserves it. And Min has a sense of self-respect and decency and a ride-or-die attitude, and she's not going to help Elida, and she's not going to leave them there. Because in the end, Swan's a dick, but she's not the kind of dick that deserves what she got. And in the end, Min knows that however much of an asshole Swan is, and however much she doesn't trust her, really, she still is ultimately on Rand's side and looking to help Rand. And so, she goes to the rescue. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Podcast of the Dragon. I'm excited to tackle this book and really looking forward to the next episode, and that's all I'm going to say about that. This week's accompanying minisode on Patreon is about Rand and Min's relationship. If you'd like to support the show and have access to that or to some other fun content, there's a link in the show notes. There are other links for Discord, for email, as well as to my new Twitter handle, which is @PodOfTheDragon. It's the same account, just a new handle. It only took me 3 books before I finally thought to Google how to change my Twitter handle, and it turns out you can totally do it. You just go into the settings rather than edit profile. Seems obvious now. There's also a link to Apple Podcasts. If you would like to leave a review for me, I'd appreciate it. I've made a promise to myself that every time I ask someone to review my podcast, I'm going to go review someone else's podcast, and I'm hoping good karma will pay itself forward. Fingers crossed with that. If you know anyone who likes The Wheel of Time and might be interested in a different kind of podcast, please tell them about me. My music is by Kevin MacLeod. My name is Morgan, and I haven't done fool things because of a fool man since 2019, and it is wearing on me. I'm so ready for COVID to be over.